Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I am your host, Graham Culbertson, and we're here to talk about a topic today that I am very interested in. I also wish I knew a lot more about, which is why we're here to talk about this concept of radical antiquity. So, Chris, if you could tell the listeners first who you are and about this book, Radical Antiquity, and then we can just keep going.
Sure, sounds great. My name is Chris Zeichman. I live in the city of Toronto. I'm kind of a specialist in antiquity and religion, and I recently published this book called Radical Antiquity, Free Love Zoroastrians, Farming Pirates, and Ancient Uprisings, which is sort of this effort to think about anarchism and antiquity as a set of practices and communities, and not simply philosophical abstractions and so on, right? So kind of how are people engaging in radically democratic forms of engagement? A word I know is controversial within anarchism as well, but at least that's the direction I want to push it.
What do you mean is controversial? We can go ahead and start there with the controversy.
Sure. Yeah, so I think, I guess sort of my own experience, sort of this word of democracy is a very loaded term when we talk about anarchism, right? That on the one hand, it can very much carry that kind of rule of kind of the tyranny of the majority and sort of that capacity for we think of segregation in the United States being something that was very much a product of sort of democracy in that sense, right? And a lot of other sort of very unjust laws that were quite popular but oppressive. On the other hand, the direction that I wanted to push it, thinking in this line of sort of how the word democracy was used in antiquity, it's sort of as this egalitarian form of consensus decision-making, right? Which I think tends to fit with a lot of how anarchistic communities organize themselves, engage in decision-making there, right? And with this, trying to kind of take sort of activist senses of the word and relate that to sort of, the ancient Greek sense of the word, right? Where democracy was this controversial topic back in the day too, right? We find everything from Plato loathing democracy, right? He kind of talks about it as this thing where it leads the poor to rule and that the rich have no power at all. And yet we also find that people found it very empowering in the ancient world. So I'm going to think about it, not in that sense of kind of like Athens and so on, but how do people engage those sort of everyday forms of rebellion, acts of radical democracy? That way is what the goal is with the book.
Yeah, fantastic. Fantastic. So first of all, I'll say before we go any further, I really enjoyed the book. I loved all of your examples. We'll talk about that in a second. On this democracy question, I too have found the word democracy to be inflammatory with anarchists. They get really upset when you say that, you know, you like democracy. And the first, you know, the first thing I make is like, well, if someone is, you know, I follow the old Greek definition that voting for representatives is not democratic, that's an aristocratic form of government. So right there, I feel like that should neutralize the whole problem of democracy. Like if majoritarian voting is what you mean by democracy, my read is normally you don't have a really good read of democracy. The other thing, and this comes up in your book and it comes up with Athens, like I'm working on right now a way that I think this really is true, that America, the United States, really had a strong democratic current from the Constitution essentially until the Civil War. And it was a smallholder or freeholding white male Christian democracy. And we want to celebrate, or I want to celebrate, that the oligarchs had less power in this era than they did, say, in Britain. And everyone immediately is like, well, yeah, but you know that those people were all racist and they took that land from the Indians. I'm like, completely agree. Not celebrating them for crossing the Appalachians and murdering everyone who lived there. That is not the thing that I think is good about them. And I'm not trying to say we should say that American democracy in 1807 was wonderful. People know this by rote now. When you start talking about Athenian democracy, you can't say anything good about it because people just jump in and say, and you know they had slaves. And I'm like, well, shit, and would you have preferred that they had oligarchs who had slaves? Like, what if, can we not see the things that worked and were radical that we like as examples, while also criticizing the things we didn't like. I don't know what it gets people to say that, but you know they had slaves. I honestly don't know what the value of that rhetorical move is.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on this, where it's sort of kind of throughout human history, slavery in particular being really taken for granted as a legitimate political institution, including among slaves, right? That even when slaves were engaging in rebellions, right, or when they were talking about their experiences, they still assumed slavery was legitimate. They just didn't like that they had to experience it, right? Yeah. And it really wasn't until about 200, 300 years ago, not even 300 years ago, that we start to find kind of this notion of like abolitionism even being articulated as a concept that slavery as an institution is an evil, right? And of course, we're on the same side of this, right? Like, it is evil, right? Let's be clear about this. But to fault someone for like not articulating a concept that hadn't even existed yet, it's like, oh yeah, they also didn't believe in gravity because that concept hadn't been articulated yet, right? It's all these sorts of things where there's certain power dynamics they had blind spots to, right? They weren't able to account for and consider. But that doesn't mean there isn't something useful to us or even to others in antiquity, right? So kind of how even people took sort of Athenian democracy and then did push it even more radical directions relative to what we find in Athens or Sparta or Rhodes or take your pick there, right?
Yeah, good. No, good. I'm glad of course we're in complete agreement on the fact that slavery's bad, but I'm glad we're in agreement on this on this case that we're, and this is for me again broadly, the scholar Luke Kemp, who I've had on my podcast, and then David Graeber, who was in many ways the inspiration for this podcast, they both more or less define democracy and anarchy as roughly the same thing. And until you get people praising democracy, like everyone wants to be pro-democracy. Well, most people want to be pro-democracy in, let's say, the Western world over the past 200 years. Graeber's very convincing in his book, The Democracy Project, that anarchy and democracy are synonyms for most people. And the fact that they've started praising democracy, the people who used to attack both anarchy and democracy and define them as the same thing, now that those people have started praising democracy, the anarchists have turned around and started attacking democracy. And I'm like, no, I mean, this is definitely what Luke Kemp says. He just says, let's take the claims of democracy seriously. And when those oligarchs say, I believe in democracy, it's like, great. So you're going to give up all your billions of dollars and we're going to stop having a voting system and we're going to start having radically self-organizing communities. And they're like, that's anarchy. And I'm like, yeah, you goddamn right. Democracy is anarchy. I guess you didn't know that. Maybe you haven't been doing your reading lately. That's my take on it. I understand why people hear the word democracy and they think of, you know, George W. Bush doing imperialism in the name of democracy. Right. I understand. George W. Bush claimed that the Iraq War was, quote, democracy or spreading democracy. I get it, but I'm not going to let him take our word.
Absolutely. I completely agree. It's like this way in which I didn't go so far as to say, I think like this notion of democracy has become a sort of legitimating force or legitimating rhetoric, right? Like precisely with that George Bush example, we need to liberate and bring democracy. And even like, I think it's something like 7 countries in the world today do not explicitly self-define as democracies, either in their names or their like official documents or anything. And it's even like North Korea, right? The Democratic People's Republic of Korea, right? Like, I don't know that I would call that meaningfully a democracy, right? Maybe some people would. I certainly would not. And yet it still claims to be that in its very name there, right? It's the notion of democracy just changed so wildly from what it used to mean, as you said, just a few hundred years ago, where it was so almost synonymous with anarchism and anarchy, right?
Yeah, we're not going to convince anyone to join our side if we're like, yeah, we hate democracy. That's just a bad position to take. I mean, again, this is not my idea. Graeber makes this claim frequently, and I don't know if he does it specifically on democracy, but Cory Doctorow says the same thing. If there's something that people like and are in favor of, there's a concept that they're in favor of, saying like, actually, you know, here on the left, we're against that thing. That's not a winning That's not a winning move. You got to take, you got to pick your spots where people are like, yeah, we love imperialism. And you got to say, no, we on the left are against imperialism. But when they say we love democracy, I think that's a place to start a conversation and do some bridge building.
Yeah, not the time for the well actually approach, as it
were. Yes, exactly. There's probably as much anyways. I mean, I'm always trying to do the well actually about the other stuff, right? Which sure, to say sure. I don't. Someone says I don't like anarchy. Well, the next thing I wanted to make sure we talked about is one thing I haven't explored on this podcast and I've wanted to do for a long time is the Greek concept of anarchy. And, mm-hmm. you know, Plato, as you mentioned in your book, Plato, it says anarchy is basically what happens when the system falls apart. It's the bad version of democracy. So for those of you who haven't read Plato, it's like basically like monarchy is the good form of one guy ruling, and then tyranny is the bad form. So you can have a good monarch or you can have a tyrant. Democracy is the good form of the people ruling, and anarchy is when the people get loose and they're just running around and it's mob rule. But according to you, there's also this, you know, a pre-Platonic sense or a non-Platonic sense that anarchy just means there's not a specific single boss. And in that sense, then there's anarchy becomes not Plato's bad thing, but a simple descriptor. We don't have a king in this city. It's anarchy. It's not anarchy in the sense of mutual aid and cooperation. It's not anarchy in the sense of mob rule. There's no king. There's no prime minister. That's just what it is.
Yeah, absolutely right. So kind of a lot going on with this, right? So with that sort of pejorative sense that anarchy often has in kind of the common parlance, right? That, you know, that unbridled chaos that it means in some situations. And the other end of that sort of, like you said, the sort of mutual aid and communitarian types of organization or whatever, right? Horizontal leadership doesn't necessarily mean that in those cases either, right? It's just simply descriptive saying this year we did not have, you know, someone in such and such a position, or like the commander for this military unit died, so they were in a state of anarchy, right? Not that they were killing each other, not that they were, or on the flip side, kind of engaging in mutual aid, but just simply like they're in a state where there is no leadership, all right? And it only really sort of became kind of around that time of Plato, that development of philosophy, that really started taking on those really negative connotations. We see a little bit of it earlier than that, but when we see like the earliest uses of the word anarchy, I think it's in the play Antigone by Sophocles. Antigone, who's this, you know, for those who don't know the tale, like she's the daughter of King Oedipus. And basically what happens is, you know, she's fictional, obviously. Her two brothers die. One brother died in service of the state. The other died opposing the state. And she wants to bury the brother who died opposing the state. And they say, you can't do that. And she says, well, I am an anarchist. I don't, I don't believe in the power of the state over this. I have higher duties that I need to abide by, right? That there are those kind of divine principles of like, we need to give someone a proper burial, whether or not the government says it's okay there, right? And it's only sort of over time starts taking those negative connotations, especially through that Platonic influence there that says it's chaos or it's sort of bad democracy or something like that. And sort of over as time goes on, right, democracy also starts to take on those really negative connotations too, right? Kind of the one thing is you look for it, you're not going to find any positive descriptions of democracy in antiquity or ancient authors having positive descriptions, I should say, because they're all aristocrats who hate the idea that people might have a sort of say in their own governance there, right? So yeah, so anarchy and democracy being closely related and it being a sort of a neutral descriptor there, right? Absolutely. It's something that, I don't know, I found quite surprising when I started doing this research in the first place.
Yeah, no, I mean, I didn't know this at all. I learned this from your book, so I really appreciate that. And it fits well with my sense that just everything is always anarchy in this really neutral sense. So, I mean, whether you're an American or not, you may or may not know that we're undergoing a slow motion constitutional crisis. We don't know, you know, according to this document, the U.S. Constitution, Congress is in charge, but the president says he's in charge and Congress can check him. but Congress isn't checking him, and the Supreme Court isn't really checking him either, except sometimes both Congress and the Supreme Court check him. And I'm quite happy calling this anarchy. So if you think anarchy is a governmental system, like if you think there's different kinds of governmental systems, there's one, this is the work Plato does. There's one where one person rules, and that's called a monarchy. And there's one where several people rule, and that's called an oligarchy. Then it's not anarchy. But if you think anarchy is the inability to point somewhere and say, that's where the power is, but you actually do this Foucauldian analysis that say the power is always everywhere, then every governmental system is in some way anarchic. That's neither good nor bad. It just is, you know. Yeah. That's like, and I just that's just where I want us to all start our analysis. Let's all agree, in any given situation, in any classroom, in any family, no matter what the rules say, we don't actually know where power lies and who is going to get to make the decisions. And then all of the good stuff we want should begin with that. And people who listen to this podcast a lot have heard me say this a bunch of times. I feel like generally the liberal progressive thing is like, first, let's figure out where the power lies. Then let's make sure the people using the power are doing good stuff with it. And third, let's put some checks on that power. And I'm like, no, I want to start. Step one is wrong. You can't figure out where the power lies. Let's just stop worrying about that one right now. And it puts me at odds with the whole political theoretical tradition, which I think, as you say, really begins with Plato and his student Aristotle. They really start with this, like, let's look at what these forms are and what they mean and where the power lies in them and what's good and bad in them.
Yeah, there is this like widespread, even beyond sort of antiquity or even systems like governments today, like this tendency to kind of take that sort of official text, as it were, for granted as an actual description of reality, right? Whether it is the U.S. Constitution or even say like the Catholic Church, right? That the Catholic Church is supposed to have, you know, the Pope in power and so on. It's supposed to have all these canons, but we're witnessing very clearly that's not actually the case, right? We have all these people very much disliking the Pope, saying certain nice things about immigrants and so on. We also have kind of that radical tradition in Latin America where people are having their own saints who are not authorized and so on, right? And I think once we get that ability to say, like, allow ourselves to say, like, oh, what they're telling us about how power functions is not actually descriptive of reality, I think it really opens up a lot of potential to kind of view the world in a completely different way and understand a lot of the possibilities that you previously were unable to really are there and kind of at your fingertips almost to kind of engage the world instead of just, yeah, assuming that, you know, oh, let's put the power in the good hands or here's where power really lies. You know, it's such a mess that untangling those threads is a good luck with that anyway, I would say.
Yeah. It does seem like it's a mistake to try and untangle it. Yeah. I remember when the Pope was elected, I saw some headline that was like, you know, Trump is no longer the most powerful American in the world or something like that. But that's just silly. Because the president really does, as we're seeing right now in Iran, when the president gives orders, he really can get hundreds of thousands, honestly, all told, millions of people to do what he says against their own will, conscience or no. They, you know, all sorts of people will do something like destroy the country of Iran. If the Pope tomorrow ordered, all right, everyone, let's go attack Iran, I feel pretty strongly roughly zero people would invade Iran. The U.S. military and the U.S. government has successfully centralized power. If we're using power to mean this sort of like, if one, the will of the decision maker is carried out by many people, whether they choose it or not, then the Pope, as near as I can tell, has like no power. I didn't mean to get on to the Pope. I was gonna pivot to your book, but like this is like the previous Pope, the endless stuff about like he, you know, Francis was trying to do stuff and the cardinals behind his back were just like, no, we're not doing that.
Everything.
It's like, wait, so the Pope commands literally no one? Because he gives an order to his secretary and he's like, tell them we're going to do this today. And as soon as he leaves, the secretary is like, guys, we're not doing this. Like, the Pope has no power. No one has any power except when other people surrender their wills to the people who have power. That's my, again, that's my view of it. And I think this is right, roughly. I mean, this goes back to people accepting. Well, no, never mind. I'm gonna stop on this. I'll see if you have anything you want to say about the Pope, and then we'll get back to your book.
No, I completely agree. I mean, I think that you're kind of pointing to a number of things. I'm rereading right now James C. Scott's Two Cheers for Anarchism right now. One of the things he talks about in that is sort of like how we resist in these different ways that are often very subtle, simply refusing to follow orders, right? That it's easier to just be like, yeah, no, I'm not going to do that. You're not necessarily like willfully defying anyone, right? I think of just by way of example, my own great grandfather, his situation basically leading up to World War I, he got in trouble because he was hunting on the Kaiser's land in Austro-Hungary. And he was told that he's going to be conscripted into the military and fighting World War I. He says, yeah, I'm not going to do that. So then he just like got on the boat, came over to the US. He wasn't a pacifist. He wasn't opposed to the monarchy or anything like that, but he engaged in that sort of like everyday act of saying like, I'm not going to win this war that I don't really care about. I'm not going to die for this. I'd rather just go somewhere else, especially for a stupid crime like hunting on, you know, this monarch's property, right? This is not a real crime anyway. And so I just say like, yeah, I completely agree, right? That only insofar as we grant these powers, we surrender ourselves to them. And it's very easy if we allow ourselves to kind of say, well, this person, what authority do they actually have over me? Often it's a lot less than they want us to think it is anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's absolutely right. All right. Before we get to the examples from your book, there's one more thing I want to talk about, which is, you know, I often describe myself on this podcast as an intellectual historian, and I do that for a few reasons, but one of that is just, I mean, I just find, for one thing, I find being an intellectual historian the easiest kind of historian to be, because the ideas are right there. And occasionally other historians will come out and be like, well, actually, it turns out no one was reading the Federalist Papers in 1787, so they're not actually that important. I'm like, well, as an intellectual historian who's studying the ideas, whether these ideas were read by anyone is completely irrelevant to me.
Sure.
It's even harder to be any other kind of historian in antiquity, because we cannot, whatever texts are out there, if they've been translated into English, we can all read them and see these ideas. And this is one of the places you start in your book, along with, you know, defining anarchy, is this question of, you know, people like, I think Zeno, you mentioned, who have been intellectual historians of anarchism, especially the greatest intellectual historian of anarchism, Kropotkin, is like, yeah, here's these ideas. We find them in Zeno, or Oscar Wilde finds them in Lao Tzu. You're trying to do a social history and say, no, this is not where people wrote down authority is bad, F you, all Athenian cops are bastards, or something like that. Right. But you're actually trying to find various times that people in antiquity lived in these anarchic ways. And that just strikes me as, I mean, someone who focuses on 19th and 20th century texts, seems impossible. I mean, I'm quite convinced by the book, but I'm just like, holy shit, how do we know how these, you know, Mike Duncan said at one point on his podcast that Christianity was the religion of women and slaves. And like, you have found the places where either because we have their voices or because we have the bad things other people said about them, we can actually see the lives of women and slaves. And it's a lot easier to see what a Roman senator has to say than an Athenian woman. So I just want to know how you managed to do social history when we know so little about these everyday practices.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for it's a great question, right? Because yeah, I think you're pointing to kind of a few things, right? So the data for these groups that survives the evidence is often very sparse, right? So we're talking groups at the margins of society. Often people who are not literate within these groups are not able to write down their own experiences in the first place. And the people who were writing about them loathed them, right? Like they had very little good to say about them. And so this kind of creates this situation where, like, well, what the heck do we know about them, right? And in some cases, you can kind of look at multiple sources that are independent of each other and say, all right, we can kind of suss out these commonalities that will indicate something about this or that group. Other times we can draw upon archaeology, which will give us a bit more evidence. So in the case, one sort of short interlude chapter is about the region of Phrygia and kind of this area of modern day Turkey, that is, where people basically resisted power by refusing to read, refusing to write, and just kind of gave up the written word as a way of saying, you know, this is how governments are exerting power over us. And we just notice archaeologically this massive decrease in, you know, writings and everything in this region over the course of a millennium and the resulting statelessness in that region. But yeah, the social history can be very complicated. And especially over the course of these different ones, it really kind of required different methods depending on the chapter. Some of these groups are pretty well known. So I'm going to guess most listeners have at least heard of Spartacus, right? The gladiator who led the revolt. There's, you know, I think even a new H Stars show. I can't remember what network. There's a new TV show on about it now. It's written the Kirk Douglas movie with Stanley Kubrick as well. And other ones are going to be less well known, right? So I think like that you mentioned the Christians, right? The Circumcellions, this kind of radical Christian group where they really only pop up here and there as sort of the bad guys in the writings of these sort of, you know, kind of Catholic writers living in the 4th, 5th centuries anyway. And so if we kind of draw those together, what can we ascertain about them? And it's just sort of often very residual evidence, right? Very little of it that people wrote about themselves, but we can still see those kind of fingerprints here and there to be able to at least learn a thing or two about them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I'm very familiar. The place I'm most familiar with doing this kind of work is obviously we have a lot of writing about the Caesars of Rome. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, the good Caesars and there's the bad Caesars. But a lot of times you'll, you know, find out that the person who wrote about how bad the bad Caesar was the official court historian of the Caesar who overthrew him. And it's just like, exactly. Well, okay, so let's try and find the truth here. And definitely, you know, like some of the most famously bad Caesars, Commodus is one, and maybe also Nero. One mm-hmm. of the things that's very clear that was very bad was that they wasted lots of money on throwing parties. And it seems like, in yeah. fact, that some of these parties might have been for normal people in Rome. So if you were a normal person in Rome, maybe you wouldn't think Commodus was the worst emperor of all time because he wasn't doing enough war. Instead, he was spending lots of money on people in Rome. At least that's one of the complaints about him. Maybe yeah. Commodus was as bad as they say he is, but it's also possible to think, like, wait a second. Was the average Roman just like living a nonstop party during Commodus's time and also being really glad that he didn't have to go off and die in a frozen forest in Germany? That all of a sudden this Commodus guy starts sounding kind of awesome, but you have to read what the people said about Commodus in this weird backwards way. And it's difficult to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. Commodus is a great example for this too, right? Because I would even go maybe a step further, right? That kind of our best historian for Commodus is someone who knew him, was living at the time, a senator who's just like, I can't believe this guy is just degrading the office of the emperor, right? He's acting like a commoner. He likes spending time with all these poor people. He likes gladiators, right? And gladiators are kind of like slaves and stuff like that. These are the people he's trying to impress and so on. And yeah, it's like, you know, probably if you're a common, you know, Roman citizen in the city, like, yeah, this guy rules, right? Like, I'm getting all this entertainment, these gladiatorial games and stuff like that. You know, not to say he's necessarily, you know, good policy or anything like that. Not to say, you know, he could have used his money maybe more wisely in this or that way. But yeah, absolutely, right? I think that the bias of these sources is just so flagrant at times that it's hard to take seriously what they say. If you even just be like, just ask a simple question of who the heck is telling us this or that about this you know, ancient emperor, this ancient, you know, gladiator, this or that person, right? That it's just so obvious sometimes that you can't take these at face value.
Yeah. Good. Yeah. No, that's excellent. Yeah. I do think, you know, I think Commodus probably, I mean, that's why I picked him in particular. Seems like he was sure. probably a pretty democratic hero, of the people. And maybe Nero was as well, which is just crazy because everyone knows Nero was the absolute worst. But again, All of the bad emperors were bad because the senators hated them. And if you know
anything, aristocratic, right?
Yeah. If you know anything about the Roman senators and the people they liked and what they did, then the emperors they hated, they start looking pretty good.
Absolutely.
Okay. We're moving towards the end of our time, and I want to make sure that I give you a chance to say a few things about whatever you would like to say. But before we do that, the one that I wanted to bring up from your case studies that I thought was really striking and useful was when you wrote about the cynics. So, and especially this connection with lifestyle anarchism. So let me try and lay it out a little bit and you can be the expert and take it away. But one of the things that comes up a lot of times when you are talking, at least for me, I'm just going to speak from myself, from my personal experiences.
Sure.
When I'm talking about ideas with people and I'm talking about anarchy, a lot of times people will say something like, well, Graham, you're missing everything. You're not talking about the big picture. You're not talking about communal things. So like if I say something like, you know, everyone should just be able to leave whatever polity they want to whenever they want to. And people say like, Graham, that's insane. People can't just be, do you know how hard it would be for people to just leave and leave their families and tear everything apart? And I just have to blink and say like, no, I didn't say that everyone should be leaving all the time. And I didn't say that it wouldn't hurt. And, you know, for most people who are not in an abusive home, that it wouldn't be a terrible and difficult thing to leave. Indeed, for people in abusive homes, it can be a terrible and difficult thing to leave. I'm simply saying, contrary to the standard rule that you have to stay in the home that you're in and you have to stay in the country you're in, that you should be allowed to leave. I'm not arguing for a world in which everyone wakes up every morning and thinks, I think I'll just walk away and every society is always collapsing. It strikes me that this is the reading you're doing against the critics of the cynics. Are you following? Who say like the cynics say like, yeah, we're not going to do all the stuff that we're supposed to do. And some people say like, oh, well, the cynics, they didn't care to do what they were supposed to do. But it's more like the cynics said, I'm not going to do what you tell me to do. That doesn't mean I'm not going to be a good person and be a member of a community, although it seems like maybe Diogenes wasn't. But there's this problem that when the anarchists say no one should be forced to do these things, then people respond like, yeah, but someone needs to be a farmer. It's like, no, I didn't say anyone. I didn't say no one should farm. I said no one should be forced to farm. There's a really big difference there.
Yeah, I think that kind of, I think that's a huge part of this cynic way of doing things, right? The idea that we kind of have these very arbitrary power structures, these very arbitrary rules that are imposed upon us throughout our lives, right? And the idea that we should feel free when we want to let go of those, right? So in the sort of Greco-Roman context, you might think of like those certain values to let go of. So kind of notions of what an honorable family looks like or what an honorable, respectful relationship looks like. Right. So again, are you someone who's comfortable hanging out with sex workers and stuff like that? Or are you someone who's only, you know, needs to be a lawful marriage type thing, right? Or even just sort of like, you know, having a respectable job and so on, right? This whole idea, I would kind of push this further, is, you know, kind of even within our own society, I suppose, that we kind of had this sense of jobs that are below people and those who are not too, right? That we aren't quite an honor and shame society in the same way. But I do think a lot of like, you know, no one should be forced to be a farmer. But I also think like a lot of people kind of are forced into it now precisely because of our social situation, right? Or forced into other jobs that maybe they wouldn't want to do. I know, for instance, again, I'm an American dual citizen, U.S. Canadian. And when a lot of my friends come visit the U.S., they're often immediately struck when they land at the airport where it's like all the service workers are racialized, right? And it's, you know, nothing wrong with being a service worker, but like there's a situation where kind of jobs that are often not as glorious, not as well paying, people are kind of forced in these positions. They don't have those opportunities to, hey, why can't I just be a philosopher, right? And this is kind of one of those things with the cynics too, right? The idea that Plato has that really the only legitimate philosopher is someone who is independently wealthy, can sit all around all day while the slaves serve him. And, you know, he's got his estate making money for him and so on. If you're making money teaching, then you're a sophist. You're not a real philosopher. And, you know, basically Diogenes, the other cynics were saying, well, why the hell is that the case, right? Why can't a poor person, you know, a beggar, be just as legitimate a philosopher, live an ethical life there and reflect on these weighty matters in the same way anyone else can, right? And so kind of how there are these kind of things within society that push people one or another direction. And yeah, like we should, in my mind at least, and yours as well, like an ideal society, we should have that ability to refuse, right? That should be one of those things where we can freely say, yeah, I don't think I want to do that. I think I'd like to find another way of doing things rather than farming all day or
yeah. You know,
only wealthy people get to do the fun stuff or whatever, right?
Yeah, exactly. And if you're saying no one should be forced to be a farmer, you're not saying I want to live in a world in which no one makes food. You're saying we can figure out together without coercion how to make food. I mean, the other example that came to my mind when you were talking is like if you want to enforce like heterosexual monogamy.
Sure.
Okay, fine. That's your thing. But let's say we get rid of having society enforcing heterosexual monogamy. We get rid of, you know, the connection between marriage and childbearing and the state and taxes and everything. That's not going to stop a young man and a young woman from living together and having lots of children and only having sex with one another. There's no scenario in which we get rid of the enforcement. I mean, we're not saying everyone should be forced into queer polygamy. It's simply let's drop the enforced heterosexual monogamy. Heterosexual monogamists get to do their thing just like everyone else. We're just asking to remove the privilege on this one way of being. And somehow, you know, and some of the smarter social conservatives, I can't believe I'm going to give this label to David Brooks. Like David Brooks will make this claim that like, you know, when you enforce it, it strengthens it and it brings the ties of society together. And that's something I disagree with, but that's a coherent argument. Like he's actually saying like these institutions will strengthen the human heart. I think that's bullshit, but that's different from just saying like, no, if you get rid of marriage, then men and women can't live together anymore. Like who said that? No one said that.
Is this wild mischaracterization? And it's weird to like how much nowadays, like, this is just, I don't know, over the past like 5 years, maybe 8 years now, like this discourse where it's like even opening up the possibility of doing things differently means that you're forcing people to accept it or whatever, right? It's like, accept it, don't accept it. I don't care what your opinion of it is in the end, but like, this is ultimately like, it's going to happen. And acknowledging that's going to happen, it's probably better for many of you, even if you don't like it, to accept that like, hey, you know what? Maybe two men want to kiss. Maybe three people want to live together or whatever it is, right?
The only thing we're asking is that you stop using the coercive, violent power of the state to stop two men from kissing. Is that really really destroy your entire world that you can't put them in prison anymore? And clearly, for some people, it does. But I think there's also people who are reachable out there that's just like, hey, under Diogenes' rule, you can feel as much. By rule, I don't mean his control, but under Diogenes' sense of how one should be, you can feel as much shame as you would like about whatever you want to feel shame about. You're just not allowed to make Diogenes feel shame anymore. So let it go. It's gonna be okay.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
All right, Chris. Before we get out of here, I just wanted to make sure that any of the things that we skipped over much of the book, which is good. So one, so people can read the book, and two, because we'd be talking for 3 hours if we covered
Sure.
everything in it. I had some other favorites here, but I got everything out of this conversation I wanted to. So what else about this experience or any of the other case studies would you like to share with the listeners before we're done?
Sure. Yeah. Well, thank you. So the book, just for those who don't know, it's out by Pluto Press. There's also an audiobook you can find. So, ask your local library to get a copy if you don't have one, if you don't want to get your own audiobook copy. But most libraries can do that. But yeah, sort of the book just sort of goes through a number of different case studies, mostly independent of each other, and tries to think through how they're engaging in sort of radical egalitarian forms of kind of organizing and making decisions in ways I think are pretty exciting. The one that I personally found most fun when writing the book, I'm glad you liked Diogenes and the Cynics, but writing about pirates, something about that brought out my inner like 6-year-old. I was surprised when writing this about how little research had been done on like Greco-Roman pirates. And it's like, it is, that was a very fun chapter to write. My partner would like just see me staring out the window sometimes, and she'd be like, "Are you thinking about pirates again?" I'd be like, "So think about pirates." So again, pirates, I think are pretty useful, pretty fun concept in general throughout human history. Certainly in antiquity, I think have a pretty fun way that they understand democracy and really engaging in criticizing and taking on in a military way almost sort of the empires of the Mediterranean there. But yeah, just I hope it's a fun book. I hope it's a book that people listen to the audiobook or buy their own copy or whatever they want to do, that they'll have a hopefully have a blast while reading it anyway, because it was very fun to write and research.
Yeah, no, it was fun to read. I'm trying to write a book myself, and I'm trying to reading your book, I thought this is the kind of tone and pace that I need to teach my after years of academic right decades of academic writing. This is the kind of tone and pace I need to teach myself. And then just briefly on pirates, I was reading a blog post by Corey Robin, who is a political theorist I really like. But he compared, I really didn't like this. There was some real bad behavior by ICE, as there always is, and he compared them to pirates and was sort of like, they were being, lawless and taking things because they like ate lunch, but then they like arrested the people who had, created their lunch. I was like, that Corey Robin, pirates are, if there's someone out there right now that I should be afraid of, it would be pirates. Like ICE and pirates are on opposite sides. Pirates are not the people who show up and say, "Hello, we represent the government." That's not what pirates do. And there's this sense, I guess there's still the sense that pirates are the enemies of all mankind, and we got to practice that James C. Scott anarchist squint and look at who's making this claim that pirates are the enemies of all mankind. And you're likely to find it's the Imperial Navy and His Majesty's Royal Merchants who are claiming that they are the enemies of all mankind. And so
Absolutely.
when the Delphic lead, extinguishes piracy, when Athens stops piracy, the way they stop piracy is asserting military control over all of the places that used to be preyed on by the pirates and murdering anyone who rejects Athenian control. That that's you'd much rather have pirates than the Athenian Navy show up in your harbor. The pirates are way better. At least they're going to leave.
Yeah, absolutely right. They'll let you live more or less free there. You bribe them every once in a while, they go away. Usually they just want to harass you and shake you down. They're not gonna, they really don't want to harm you because that's a lot of work for them to do, right? They don't want to risk their own lives. Absolutely. I would much rather have pirates than ICE any day.
Yeah, absolutely. Excellent, Chris. Anything else before we go?
No, I just want to thank you again for having me on, Graham. It was a wonderful conversation. Appreciate your time.
Oh, such a pleasure. Awesome.